Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. And my next guest noticed a statistic recently that will make Republicans' heads spin. The stock market under President Obama is now officially performing better than it did under Ronald Reagan during the legendary boom of the 1980s. Robin Farzad is that writer. Robin is a contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek, and he joins me now. Hello, Robin Farzad. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. How are you? May I please put out a public display of affection before we talk? Miss you. I miss you so much. I moved from Manhattan last year to Richmond, Virginia, where I am now, an Iranian in the former capital of the Confederacy. Loving it down here, but I so miss coming to Varick Street and doing work in studio with you, and it's so great to be back in the high life again.
Guys aren't supposed to talk like this. I'm getting really anxious.
I have a man. You know about my man crush. You know it's a bromance.
So let's have some guy talk and talk stocks, because yesterday the Dow hit a record high of 15,746. Where is it this morning? Have you been watching the TikTok?
Everybody is just fixating on Twitter, which we'll talk about later. But it is set to open up again at another record high. The S&P 500, which is the broader index, is up 25% year-to-date since the all-time low set in March of 2009, when there were Wall Street stress tests going on and Citigroup was about to fail and AIG was taking more money. The market is up 190%. And those are big numbers.
All right. But a little reality check here. When Obama came into office, the financial crisis was in full swing. And the stock market was crashing. I mean, it was going down hundreds of points a day in the fall of 2008 for a while, as you remember. So was it at such a uniquely and temporarily low point that to measure it from the beginning of his administration to now is not the same thing as measuring it under Ronald Reagan?
Of course it is, but it makes for a good story hook, and of course I'm going to write it. I mean, look, the market was crashing under him, and he had this first 100 days period to push through fiscal policy. And remember, Rahm Emanuel said, never waste a good chance to use a good crisis. It turns out that the recession, the trauma, was far worse than anyone had imagined. Their fiscal plan was not enough. And in the end, they were kind of pushed aside with the Federal Reserve, the Bernanke Federal Reserve, taking these extraordinary measures, not just keeping interest rates at zero since the end of 2008, but conjuring money out of thin air in quantitative easing 1, 2, and part 3. And I've posited that if this doesn't help things pick up, then Mr. Bernanke's going to have to opt for qualitative easing, where he takes to a fireside chat and tells us it'll be okay. Not even Bernanke now. It's going to be Janet Yellen.
And yet, even here in New York, which is probably the city that has been the biggest beneficiary of the TARP, because it poured money into Wall Street, the city that's maybe been the biggest beneficiary of those Federal Reserve policies, the super low interest rates, which are designed to help the banks. Even in New York City, we just elected this progressive inequality themed mayor because things are so bad on Main Street. So what a disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street, with the Dow at a record high and yet all of this, you know, continuing depression of the middle class. And so, you know, if they're on different planets, Wall Street and Main Street, how similar is that to the 1980s?
Well, that's the story of the country writ large right now. Wall Street is having a great time in corporate America, financially at least. If you're managing the coffers, you're able to borrow at record low rates. You're able to, in such a yield-starved environment, go out and satisfy investors with a couple of points on your investment grade or junk debt and issue it for 30 years. I mean, it's laughable. And similarly, if you're Wall Street, if you're an investment bank, obviously the Twitter deal is happening this morning. You get to collect those golden crumbs again. What was it that was said in Bonfire of the Vanities? It's just been a fee bonanza. But yes, it is a story of how the other half lives. There was a bailout of all of these firms that were on the TARP hook for a while. And once they nominally paid back this bailout money, they were free to go out there and go forth and multiply and pay back dividends and seek ridiculous fees, which they're doing right now. As for Main Street, I think it's much more leveraged to the story of unemployment, which remains chronically high. There are still at least 2 million jobs that need to be recovered for us to revisit the pre-2008 crash unemployment rate. And we're not creating anything on the order of the number of monthly jobs to put a dent in that rate.
Listeners, how aware are you of the record Dow? Is your 401k fattening nicely? Does it affect your life if you're not already retired? Are you planning to invest in Twitter today? I'll give you one little spoiler here. If you didn't already invest in Twitter at the opening, it may not be the best moment right now. We'll give you the numbers in a second, as another guest is going to join us who's reporting specifically on the Twitter story today. But you can call in 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 on a record surge in the Dow under President Obama, 120% improvement during his years in office compared with 118% during the Reagan years to this point. 212-433-WNYC and anything on Twitter as an IPO, as a stock, or if you're concerned about the culture of Twitter changing or excited about it, 212-433-9692. Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Businessweek, my guest. And as calls are coming in, Robin, why don't we hear Obama crowing about this achievement? Why does it take you to kind of notice this as a reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek, this comparison, instead of seeing some kind of Rose Garden event with bells and whistles?
One, because I'm trenchant and incredibly savvy. But two, somebody's going to call Obama on this. They'll turn around and use his line. You didn't build that. And he didn't build that. This is about the Federal Reserve. And one, if everybody was participating in this, if this was like a Bill Clinton era, late 1990s stock market renaissance where people were talking about tech stocks at dinner parties and you had all of this breathless talk about the resurgence of the investor class and the ownership society and 401ks and company stock matching, that's not been the case. The individual investor has yanked record amounts from the stock market as this largely unheralded bull market has been going on. I think something on the order of $400 billion has been pulled out over the past 5 years, while Wall Street and corporate America and firms have been kind of quietly loving life. So if you're out there as Obama, you can't just extol this what you think should have been a monolithic rally. In fact, it's a rally that has disproportionately helped the financial sector but has not accrued down to mom-and-pop John Q. investor.
And there's a growth number out. I wonder how this figures into the equation of how you see things. GDP grew at 2.8% last quarter, this number just out this morning, higher than expected. But the Wall Street Journal says it might mean lower growth for the coming quarter. That's just, you know, Chinese to most people who don't speak Chinese. So what does that mean?
GDP growth is not – again, it goes back to the point that you're not having anywhere near the GDP growth that you would expect. Historically, the country, the economy would rebound in a way after the depth of this financial crater over the past several years. This was not your garden variety recession. This was one of those once-in-a-lifetime calamities. And so, again, we're not creating anything on the order of the hundreds of thousands of jobs sustainably every month to bring that unemployment rate back down to – the 5% territory, or what they used to call the natural rate of unemployment. I haven't heard that in years.
Robin, we're going to take a turn now to one specific stock making its debut today, the one we've been talking about, and that obviously is Twitter. So joining Robin and I to discuss the IPO and what it could mean for the 230 million Twitter users around the world is Tim Carmody, who writes about technology, business, and culture. He used to be senior writer at Wired, and as of this morning, he has 15,659 followers on Twitter. Hey, Tim, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me back.
And boy, oh boy, are those Twitter followers worth something this morning. All right.
I'm waiting for my dividend check.
You are coming up in the elevator, so I don't know if you've seen these latest numbers. They decided to float the IPO at $26 a share.
Mm-hmm.
It is now at $45.
That is a pretty big pop.
Were you expecting anything like this?
No. I mean, 26, they sort of played with the valuation. They did a high one, then they revised down, and then they said we're going to rise it up, and actually went higher than that at 26. And so I think the general consensus was 26 was pretty well priced. But obviously people are really excited about Twitter. And, you know, if you look at comparable stocks, Facebook priced pretty high and then didn't really do much on its opening day, and that disappointed people. So I don't know. The people who bought in, who were able to get those shares at $26, have to be feeling pretty good about themselves.
But come on, Robin, Twitter doesn't make any money. What's going on here? Is this irrational exuberance?
I mean, maybe a bit. You know, Twitter, it's not making a profit. But then again, you know, we've seen that there are a lot of successful tech companies that have been able to generate continued success and especially have success on Wall Street without making a profit that are much more mature than Twitter. I mean, Amazon is the great example of this.
You gentlemen need to use your illusion a little bit more. I mean, this is Twitter, man. This is where it's at. Tim, I remember when a coworker of mine, Steve Baker at Business Week, sometime 4 or 5 years ago, comes up to me and says, man, you got to get on this. This is where it's headed. And I look at this. I was like, you know, 140-character tweets to tell you that I just had a McDLT or something. What? Why should I invest any time in that? And yet so much of media and self-aggrandizement and the statusphere and everything that's going on right now in digital marketing has migrated to where Twitter is. We saw Twitter just hired the former head of NPR, Vivian Schiller, to run news for them. Mm-hmm. And journalists have to know and love Twitter. And so there's this idea of kind of buy the stock and think about the profitability later. And it's the kind of thinking we last saw in that great year of 1999.
Give us more on that, Robin. What does it mean for Twitter to have a news department?
If you're a journalist right now and your magazine or your website or your entire old reality is falling apart around you, and Brian, we know this. I mean, you guys at WNYC are very good about posting stuff up on Twitter and hashtags and the whole vernacular of the statusphere. You have to go out there and promote your work. You have to dutifully tell people, you're going to be on this show. Look, I wrote this story about the Obama bull market. I mentioned tickers X, Y, and Z. Heads up, main tweet to this person. You're hoping that there are people out there like Tim who can maybe share some of their 150 million followers with you. And you're looking for network effects. And there is a genius in that. Like I said, I was hugely skeptical at first when I was told to sign up for my Twitter handle. But now it makes so much sense. And I'm trying to preach that religion to fellow sources and writers and people who have been late to the game.
And this just in, Twitter stock just hit 50.
$50. Oh, my goodness.
So let's see, Tim. By my calculation, with your 15,600 followers, 78 times that each of the 230 million users would now be worth about almost $150 per user. Mm-hmm. So $150 times your 15,000 followers is like $2.5 million.
I mean, I feel like I should be able to securitize this and get some sort of loan against my Twitter collateral. I don't think it quite works that way.
Wait, you can get it in Bitcoin.
That's right. This point about news organizations is really important. I think one of the reasons why Twitter is exciting to a lot of traditional media organizations is that traditionally Silicon Valley companies approaching traditional media, whether it's news, whether it's television, whether it's movies, books, have been the enemy. Google's going to come in and digitize all your books and give them away for free. And it's going to, you know, show all your YouTube clips and, you know, take all the advertising itself. Facebook is going to create a bottomless hole for content that's never going to send anything out. And Twitter is different in that Twitter seems to actually play very nice. There's a virtuous circle of publicity where companies can own their presence on Twitter, fans can have a conversation with it, and it ultimately drives people back to the product. You know, and in addition to Vivian Schiller, they also hired the CEO of Ticketmaster. So you can start to see this situation where Twitter actually becomes a place that brings you in, you have a conversation, it understands your interests, it understands your social graph, but it also sends you away to watch things, to buy things, to read things. And That's a Silicon Valley model that advertisers, that networks, that everybody can get behind, because it does feel like something that can actually raise all boats, increase engagement, increase the reach.
But are you worried? Should Twitter be worried at all about where that advertising tipping point is? I don't think we feel over-advertised to on Twitter today. But
yeah, I mean, aren't you already feeling that on YouTube? I mean, it's become the bane of my existence, these mandatory YouTube ads that you have to watch. And Google once said, you know, do no evil. This has been a gangbuster acquisition for them, and it's worth multiples more what they paid for it. And if they still want to milk the user for every last bit of ad revenue.
Yeah. Absolutely. So today we have those sponsored tweets at the tops of our feeds. We seem to be okay.
I get them from the Olive Garden every 2 minutes.
And people, I think, are generally okay with that. But if they're going to start actually making money to satisfy the pressure of all these new stockholders, Robin, what are they going to do?
Events? Thought leadership? Thinkfluence? I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a neat analog.
There's not as much money in Thinkfluence as you think there'd be.
Oh, you are a Thinkfluencer, man. You are a thought leader.
I know. Right? I want to cash in. I'm waiting.
You're a forward-thinking person.
I want Oprah to get behind me.
I mean,
Let's talk about this, because Conan O'Brien, you know, this is happening in parallel. I think it's germane to this conversation. There's a great clip that Conan O'Brien had on his show the other night where he went out and he's hellbent on – he's become a LinkedIn influencer, which is this kind of this gated, this walled garden of people who LinkedIn holds up. LinkedIn hired a very gifted editor who used to be at Fortune Magazine and Wired. You know him, Dan Roth, who's their editor-in-chief. Mm-hmm. And you're at this nexus of kind of journalism and social media, and – he is a very important ally to have if he posts a story of yours. They did a story I recently did on Chipotle a month ago, and they posted it up a week ago, and it went all crazy viral. So you need to have allies like that. And Conan O'Brien, meanwhile, is doing this send-up of the whole idea of self-promotion on LinkedIn and Twitter. And he's like, I want you to follow me, and I want you to make me the best influencer, because that's my whole goal in life. And and you worry that at some point all of this is really going to pass a tipping point and there's going to be a backlash, but we haven't seen it yet.
Well, the thing, LinkedIn's actually a great example. So one of the big problems that happens with online media is that you have to try to understand search intent. You have to understand what users are doing the service for. So search ads work great on Google, because if you're searching something on Google, you're interested in it, and the chances are you're interested in buying something related to it. Facebook has a huge problem with search intent, because nobody really knows why people use Facebook. People go on there to socialize, they go to play on games. There's no way to actually convert that into a sale. LinkedIn is amazing for search intent, because people go on there to hire people, to get jobs. They have a very professional appearance. They want to look good. So the content is extremely high quality. And the kinds of sort of revenue things you can do with LinkedIn are tremendous. Twitter is in between, right? And so like at its best, so the idea, what Twitter would like to be, is that it would like to be like Google in the sense of search, but it would be like to be search in real time, that you're interested in finding out what's happening right now. It would like to be Facebook in the sense that it has access to that personalization, that rich social graph. It would like to be like LinkedIn in the sense that it knows your interest graph. It knows what you're about and what you're interested in. And that's one of the things that following celebrities, following news accounts can actually get a handle on. So Twitter is actually in a position to understand its users. If they get the data right, if they get the algorithms right, if they can push it out, they're not sending you the Olive Garden. They're actually sending you someplace that you want to go, because they know more about you.
I do want to go to the Olive Garden. That's the genius of it.
It's already working.
I love that place.
Listeners, we've got two questions on the table now. One is, from the earlier part of the conversation, how aware are you of the record Dow and the record surge of the Dow during the Obama administration, and do you care? And with respect to Twitter, it opened at 26. Now it's at 50. Are you still planning to invest? And what would make you stop using Twitter? What could the company do to turn you off if they over-cluttered it or over-targeted you or whatever? If you are really a Twitter user today, not if you're a kind of sit back, you know, skeptic of the whole thing or just never got involved, but if you're really a Twitter user, could anything that they do to pay off the dividends and the expected stock growth to these new shareholders turn you off? 212-433-WNYC on either of these questions. 212-433-9692 on WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. Brian Lehrer with business and technology reporter Tim Carmody and Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Business Week. And Barlow in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I have a sort of a broader question about reporting on the stock market and the economy. When I watch the economy and the stock market and pay attention to it, I think of it in contrast to where are all the jobs associated with these new highs on the stock market? And is there any possibility that the reporting will open up in the future and say, these American companies created a lot of jobs this month, but they were in China, they were in Brazil, they were in Mexico. Will that ever change, that we have a global reporting rather than just saying, gee, why isn't the American employment rate going up?
Right. And I think that is a great question. I think we have that conversation all the time. The BBC that we carry has that conversation all the time. But, Robin, what would you add?
There's so much slack in the economy right now in terms of people out there willing to do work, veterans willing to take apprenticeships or part-time labor, underemployment, that companies realize in a very cold way, by the way, that they don't have to go out and actually create full-time, full-benefit payrolls to meet demand, that there are lots of people out there who are willing to work for less and on unusual terms. And the cloud is right now with the companies, even though they're holding record cash hoards, even though their stock prices in many cases are at records. In the past, there would be enough of a demand situation, consumers out there, and there would be pricing power in a way that you could not resist in a recovery like this, going out and adding payrolls, because if you didn't, you'd be leaving money on the table. You needed salesmen. You needed more clerks. You needed people to fix cars because there was more economic activity. There's still so much slack in the system with 2 million people still needing jobs from peak joblessness that companies are in no rush to hire. They are paying out record cash in dividends, in stock buybacks. They're taking advantage of very advantageous corporate ledger domain, but hiring yet to be seen. And that's why the Fed is still at emergency policy. We still have QE3 and zero interest rates, even when the stock market's at a record.
By the way, the bear market in Twitter has just begun. It dropped from 50 to 46.
All right. Yeah.
So, boy, somebody got really rich, though.
They're
shorting. Right, this morning, selling those
shares. Twitter is now valued at about $33 billion, just so you get some context.
All of a sudden.
Yeah. What was it, 18 this morning, 17 or 18?
But is that
$33 billion.
$33 now.
This four-point drop, does this mean, Tim, that there are some suddenly fabulously rich people who bought a whole bunch of shares at 26 and just sold them at 50 an hour and a half later?
It's possible. I mean, someone's selling, or at least the demand, or someone looked at that 50 number and said, this is ridiculous. We got to slow this down.
Listeners, if that's you, if you just made your fortune and now you're going to retire to the Caribbean on what you made in the last hour and a half on Twitter stock, 212-433-WNYC.
May I say this?
Yes.
That I have traditionally abided by what I call the Iranian Contrarian Relative Index. If I have any cousins or uncles that I've never met who suddenly call me and ask me about Twitter, have me back on your show, because that's when you need to get the heck out.
That's true.
Roble in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Roble. Roble, do we have you?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You called us, right?
Yes, sir. First of all, great to see you on the Colbert Report.
Oh, thanks. It was really fun.
And basically, my worry is that Twitter's going to turn into Facebook, where they start charging us small business owners to reach, you know, our normal allotment of followers. I stopped using Facebook for my small business because of that. You know, we've got hundreds of likes, and after they went public, now I hear or I see in our posts that they only reached 14 people.
Yeah, this is a huge problem. So Facebook uses an algorithm. Twitter, still initially for the moment, there are sponsored tweets that float to the top. But generally, your tweet stream is your tweet stream. It happens in reverse chronological order. Facebook uses a complicated algorithm called EdgeRank, which in principle shows you the most relevant tweets. The other thing that it does is it really rewards pay-to-play. So all these companies that built up this huge presence on Facebook, essentially turning Facebook's into something like their corporate page, had all of these followers, accrue this community, suddenly they saw their engagement levels drop off if they were not willing to start sponsoring their posts. And I think this is the big worry from everybody. It's the worry from users. It's the worry from advertisers, is that Twitter is going to gradually become more like Facebook. It's going to become more closed, that it's going to be something where you really have a huge gap between the sort of gap between verified users, which luckily I'm one. I'm on the verified space arc out of here when the planet collapsed.
Yeah, how do I get me one of those? Who do I have to pay?
Oh, it's very complicated. You have to be part of the Illuminati. There's some hand gestures involved. But I think Twitter, you know, when you talk to Twitter about this, one of the things they say is that, you know, their product and their revenue streams are completely separate, and that they actually feel that this openness and the fact that they are willing to show you every tweet is a huge advantage and a huge differentiator from Facebook. At the same time, however, they will not promise. You know, the promises that Twitter makes now are not necessarily the promises that Twitter can keep in the future. So what is hopeful is that Twitter can stay weird, stay open, use this information from the social graph, use this sort of rich real-time thing, which is really hard to jigger, and actually make its algorithms work to make money, keeping Twitter more or less as it is and not drifting into this sort of pay-to-play Facebook world.
Luckily, I use a browser that lets you do hand gestures, so I may be able to get in on this based on the criteria you just laid out.
Are you verified, Bryant?
Yeah, you're both verified.
Okay.
That's all I want for Hanukkah. And who do I have to call? I mean, if Vivian Schiller's out there, or if Tim, maybe you want to exhort your followers to start a campaign.
You know, talk to me.
This is my one chance.
Talk to me in the green room later. And
I'm not complete without that blue check mark.
We'll pass some information
in
along.
Brooklyn. Sarah, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I was calling because I just did my first online interview, which in itself was very strange. But one of the questions was about Twitter, and I'm sort of a peripheral Twitter user. Like, I don't actually tweet anything, but I follow, various news organizations or whatever. But it was about how Twitter is essentially replacing 1-800 numbers in customer service. Mm-hmm. And that was something that that was like a new conversation to Twitter that I had never thought of before.
Well, do you know the insecurity?
You're talking about how it's going closer and closer to Facebook, and I question if that's true. If there are companies who are investing in it the way that they are investing in, like, just general customer service.
Well,
look at what some people have done. I mean, people who've been abandoned on tarmacs, thinkfluencers out there who put out tweets calling out the CEO of an airline, and suddenly corporate communications is on the scene, and they're trying to placate you with a voucher. You can exploit a corporate insecurity out there that broadly companies realize that they're very behind on this and they don't want to be called out. This is like a public flogging, and it's much more powerful than an 800 number.
Now, and more charitably, the companies are very interested in monitoring what their customers are saying about them. And this happened with blogs for a while back. You know, Heather Armstrong famously complained about her Maytag dishwasher, and then Maytag rushed her, and other companies rushed her new dishwashers. This is like 2007, 2008. It's not totally new. But I have to say, it is wonderful to, when you are frustrated, you're calling Time Warner Cable, trying to get your cable operated, and they're routing you from call center to call center, to just go on Twitter and say, "Hey, Time Warner, this is my problem. What's up?" And to have a human being respond back to you, give you the real number to call to get through. The ability of social media to actually help both customers and companies solve each other's problems is really powerful. And Twitter is one of the best examples of that. And also, again, it's one of those things that only works because it's public. If you did it on Facebook, only your friends see it. Mm. Companies wouldn't be motivated. Twitter is public. People are highly motivated to try to solve your problem.
Sarah, thanks for starting that great stretch of conversation. We'll take one more. Melissa in Rockville Center. Hey, Melissa.
Hi, good morning, guys. I was just calling because my husband and I are the original Hannity and Combs, and I've been a longtime Democrat who's been a longtime Republican, and we met under Bill Clinton, and now, you know, 17 years later, we're married with Obama, and I always ask him during the elections, why do you Republicans hate the Democrats so much? They're making you so rich. So he can never really answer that for
you
me.
I mean, because there was this big boom under Clinton, and now we have this record surge in the stock market under Obama?
It's correct.
Well, you know, I don't think CNN use James Carville and Mary Madeline together anymore, so maybe you and your husband can apply.
We need that. Hannity and Combs never had that romantic tension in the same way.
Not quite. Melissa, keep calling us. Thank you very much. And the IPO news just in is that, maybe it's finding its level, because in the short time that we've been having this conversation, this Twitter stock that opened at 26 this morning hit 50. Then it dropped to 46, 45, 44. Now it's back up to 45 and a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So still, though, $20 a share in the first 2 hours of trading. Somebody's making money.
They can buy the New York Times 30 times over right now with this inflated currency.
And again,
they just decided to do it.
Compete with Michael Bloomberg, who wants to do that.
This is the other thing about the IPO is that, you know, as Twitter, I mean, again, they're raising capital, and most of it that they sold themselves, they sold at that $26 price. But, if their stock is worth more, they're now in a position to acquire other companies. They're in a position to, offer real incentives that they can actually really grow their product from this point forward because their company's just worth
more. But one other thing. Isn't this really risky as an investment in a certain respect because of how fast things change in terms of what websites and what social media people use? And, you know, who remembers Netscape? And, you know,
You can get on healthcare.gov really well with Netscape.
Yeah,
actually.
Right. I know. Invest in healthcare.gov while it's cheap. Mm-hmm. Ha ha. But if some other social media thing pops up and it's as awesome a technology as Twitter is. Twitter is just 5 years old, 6 years old. We could all just migrate there and then poof, this all deflates.
Yeah. And I mean, this is one of the worries is that, you know, you look at some of these newer social networks that are actually very different. You know, so Instagram, which of course got bought by Facebook, there's Snapchat, which is completely ephemeral. Forget real time. Snapchat is totally private. So the worry is always that the early adopters, the kids, the people who kind of drive innovation are going to migrate to something else and that these companies are going to be part of the graveyard. But
do you want the cautionary tale to this? I just did a story yesterday on Facebook being worth $120 billion, and it's primed to be added to the S&P 500. And it'll be interesting how a company of that heft, which is already the size of Disney, is going to be crammed into this index. But going back to December of 1999, AOL, then the cat's meow, was worth $220 billion at its peak. Mm-hmm. And Steve Case had the good vision and the prescience to realize that this is fleeting. I mean, heck, I might be irrelevant. So he goes out and buys a hard asset in Time Warner. Great for AOL shareholders, the worst thing in history for Time Warner shareholders. and you might see that kind of thinking for the likes of Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook is use it before you lose it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook are, again, particularly Facebook and LinkedIn. Twitter's a little bit unusual because they're going to the market earlier. This is a little bit more like the dot-com. Facebook and LinkedIn were really mature businesses when they went public, and they're in a position where, you know, someone said the other day, Facebook is the first social network that's in a position to actually be forever. And I think LinkedIn is similar. Twitter is maybe. It kind of feels robust enough and strong enough that it could get there. But then again, you know, Research in Motion, BlackBerry, sort of another example. It happens
fast. You and I were MySpace friends, weren't we?
We may well have been.
And with Twitter stock at $45.70, we end this conversation with Robin Farzad, senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, and media and technology and business writer Tim Carmody. At Tim Carmody?
At T. Carmody.
Yeah. And that's verified.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you both. This has been a great conversation. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Thank
Brian.
You, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll compare our New York childhoods with New York today with Roger Rosenblatt, who does just that in a new book. Stay with us.